Not only does the environment change over time, so does our interaction with it. And not just in trying to take better care of the land, the trees, the water, and the air, but in our approaches to that care. Some of the key gains in environmental protection have come through legal action. For example, a lawsuit filed on behalf of the northern spotted owl was a key event in the protection of the bird and the forests in which it lives. Our first guest is well-versed in environmental law and the recent use of the public trust doctrine in legal action. Mary Wood is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program at the University of Oregon School of Law. She'll be in the Rogue Valley in October at part of the Climate Summit talking about asserting public trust rights to secure our climate future. Mary Wood, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Give us some idea, then, of the basic roots of the public trust doctrine. This goes back quite a while, apparently, in legal circles.
Well, it's a very ancient doctrine. It's been in our country since the beginning of our legal system. But it actually goes back further than that. It can be traced back to Roman law. It's also reflected in the Magna Carta of England. And to some extent, in indigenous systems. It's a way of thinking about government's duties towards their citizens, and it's a very simple concept. It views our crucial natural resources as held in trust, a perpetual endowment for present and future generations of citizens. So the logic is really necessary to support civilization.
Is it things like making sure that the water is preserved for all the people who use it, that the land is there for all the people who use it, and so forth?
Precisely, the crucial natural resources like water, air, wildlife, and I would just say ecology now in general, have to be preserved for the use of the full public, all the citizens, and also that it has to be preserved for future generations, otherwise we won't have an enduring nation. And so the public trust principle just simply views these crucial resources as held in trust by government for the people. So the people actually are beneficiaries of this trust. We all have property rights in these crucial resources that we share in common, and government can't take those away from us. That's the heart of the principle.
That's interesting. So property rights, I mean, and when we hear that term, we tend to think in terms of this is my land and you can't take it from me, but this is more of a collective kind of thing. And of course, when you start saying collective in America, you can get in political trouble.
Well, yeah, this is American. This has been around since the beginning of our nation. And so we have two types of property rights in this country. We have private property rights, which you just talked about, and then we have public property rights. When we go out to public lands, for example, we all own those public lands in common together. So actually the public property rights are just as prominent as the private property rights, and in fact, in some sense, they're more important to the endurance of the nation because they supply the water and air and, you know, climate system that supports our survival. So if we lose those, there's chaos. So that type of ecology is so important to us that the law protects it through the public trust doctrine.
Has the public trust doctrine been used as the cornerstone, for example, of things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, things like that?
Well, the public trust underlies all of those statutes, but when we talk about statutory law, statutes are passed by Congress or state legislatures. So the statutes you mentioned were passed by Congress, and of course those are tools to carry out the trust obligation that government has towards the people. But statutory law is a very shallow area of law. The public trust goes far deeper than statutory law, because it actually binds the legislatures themselves. The legislatures are the trustees, so they have a duty to the people to carry out these obligations of protection. And if they violate those, that's a constitutional violation at its heart. And so public trust law goes far deeper than any statute can. In some sense, you can think of these statutes as having to be measured by the public trust.
But are they often done that way, or is it more a case if we pass this and then we'll think about what the deeper ramifications might be later when somebody challenges us, as in court?
Well, that's exactly right. Our statutes have dominated the legal landscape now for 40 years, since the 1970s. And what has happened is those statutes rose and they became so complex. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands of pages of regulations implementing all of these laws on the federal and state level. So environmental attorneys and government officials, and to a large extent judges too, just know only that system. They gravitated towards that and they expected answers from that. And now that we're approaching climate emergency, or we're in climate emergency, the statutes aren't enough to solve our problems. And we find, too, that Congress and our state legislators are not willing to act to avert our crisis. And so that has caused many attorneys across the country to look to a deeper source of law, which is the public trust.
So in essence, you're pruning off a lot of shrubbery that has grown over the foundation or the fundament of the public trust.
Well, in a sense, yes. You know, I talk about the statutes as marvelous tools when they are used for the public, but when they are used for industry, they are disastrous to the people, to the citizens of this country. And that is what we have seen over the last 30 years is really the agencies implementing these laws are using them to benefit the industries that they are supposed to regulate rather than the public that they are supposed to protect. So they have turned this statutory system basically into an all-out permitting system. Every proposal requires a whole lot of permits, but those permits are almost always granted. And they allow colossal destruction, waste, and literally poisoning of communities.
We're talking about environmental law with Mary Wood, who is the professor at the University of Oregon and faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program at the University of Oregon School of Law. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about law and the environment. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here is a call from Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and Mary Wood.
Yeah, Mary, glad to hear from you this morning. I graduated from your law school many years ago. But the public trust doctrine, I believe in it thoroughly, but I wanted to talk about this Cherniak case in which certain persons are trying to get the courts to advance it as opposed to the legislative bodies. Are you familiar? I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yes.
It's up on appeal to the Court of Appeals right now.
Right, Cherniak versus Kitzhaber. All right, thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it. So this is the Cherniak versus, it began as Cherniak versus Kitzhaber, it became Cherniak versus Brown when the governors changed, but on appeal again. Are you directly involved with that, or did they just use your idea of the public trust?
No, I'm not an attorney in any of this litigation. I don't practice law. So I originated the idea behind it, but no, I'm not involved in the litigation itself. But this Cherniak case is part of many cases across the country right now pending against government brought on behalf of youth to try to force the government to address the climate crisis in time before we pass tipping points of no return. So to put this in context, the climate system has its own laws, and there are tipping points and feedback loops where if we push beyond those, it won't matter if we reduce carbon to zero. It would be too late. Literally, nature would put so much carbon into the atmosphere from, say, the melting of the permafrost across the northern latitudes that we are consigned to basically what we could think of as runaway planetary heating. So that is the context for these cases. Now, what these cases do is rely on the public trust doctrine to assert a duty that government has to reduce carbon emissions in accordance with the best available science. And here in Oregon, like many other states, our government has been asleep at the wheel in terms of looking at what is required to address this situation. There have been small measures, scattered measures, but now we are in a state of such urgency. The government has to actually plan to reduce carbon emissions according to what the best available science says. That's what these cases ask the court to order. They don't ask the court to develop the plans. That's the trustee's job. That's the legislature's job and the agency's job. These cases ask the court to order a plan, basically order the other branches to start doing their job. And that is really in my mind, what we need most in this state and other states as well is a court to focus the legislative attention on this matter. Because if you talk to legislators up in Salem, they're everywhere. They're just scattered across all sorts of issues, and they're not paying attention to the crisis of our day. So this kind of case brought in states across the country and now in nations around the world would focus their attention on the job. So it doesn't usurp the role of the other branches in any way, but it does focus their attention.
Mary Wood, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor at the University of Oregon School of Law and faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about public trust and other uses of law in environmental cases. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. I want to go back a couple of minutes. You said the climate system has its own laws, and just to clarify, we're talking about the laws of physics here, not laws as in courts, right?
Right. Okay. We're talking about the laws of nature, but when I teach environmental law, I always start with the point that our environmental law has just one purpose, and that's to keep our society in compliance with the laws of nature. And one of those is that the climate system has certain requirements. Another is that human beings need water. So those are the kinds of laws I'm talking about.
And how have the courts generally responded, particularly when confronted with cases with the public trust doctrine? We've seen that there was limited success with the Chernag versus Kitzhaber case that had to go to the Court of Appeals just to be heard in the first place and then was dismissed anyway, and now it's on appeal again.
Right. The early cases and also the Cherniak case fell into this trap that we find judges who know mainly the statutory system think that this is a job for the legislatures and the agencies. So they say, hey, it's not my job. And that was what the judge basically said in the Cherniak case. Well, of course that's right. Of course it's not their job. The point is that these other branches of government are not doing their job. And so courts more recently are, I think, with the climate headlines so devastating, are beginning to wake up to their role that it really is their job to enforce the fundamental rights of citizens of this country. And so while this Cherniak case is on appeal to the north of us, there was a landmark victory handed to youth plaintiffs. These are young people who sued the governor of Washington. And the court there said, yeah, the state of Washington has to go back and review its denial of the petition. Youth had asked the state of Washington to take action on climate change, and the state agency admitted climate is a sets up disaster for these young people, but wasn't going to do anything about it. Also in the Netherlands, there was a huge citizen suit against the government over there, and the court came out ordering the government to accomplish massive carbon reduction by 2020. I think it was 25%. So I think as the climate headlines are becoming more almost unbelievable to people and drastic, the courts will realize that their role is to focus the other branches on their job.
Let's take another call here. We have Julie in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking environmental law with Mary Wood from the University of Oregon.
Thank you for taking my call. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mary Wood, I just heard your name this week, and I'm so excited for the kind of law school you are promoting and teaching. I belong to a community rights group here in Ashland that is just starting up since the month of May. We're becoming more and more organized. And I wanted to know how you feel about or how you might direct a group at this point in time, just maybe a word of encouragement to the activity that we believe is possible to be the legislature and write our own laws if the legislatures of our government aren't. For some reason, they're in some sort of a stranglehold and are not writing the laws we need. How do you see the effectiveness and the possibility of us writing our own laws, the citizens ourselves?
Yeah. And that's a wonderful question. Citizen groups and communities all over the country are moving forward in a community rights initiative that you described. So this is gaining tremendous momentum. It is very synergistic with the public trust. The public trust just says government answers to the people. the community rights initiative says basically the same thing. Both, I think, recognize that government has been co-opted by largely corporations. The one thing I would say is that community rights ordinances across the country often omit public trust language. So when writing these ordinances, it's very important to, I think, talk about the public trust and express that the community has public trust rights in its resources, and the government has certain obligations towards the people on those. The reason this is so important is because the public trust is a constitutional concept. And so when you're trying to hold legislators accountable, or legislatures accountable, you need constitutional grounding. And without the public trust, you may not have that. There was a case, which was a historic case 2 years ago in Pennsylvania, which found that a fracking statute that allowed fracking was unconstitutional under the public trust. And the Supreme Court Chief Justice over there in Pennsylvania said, the public trust establishes inalienable, inherent rights held by the citizens that are inviolate. That is language that traces back literally to the beginning of this country and the constitutional understanding between citizens and their government. So I would urge you to incorporate public trust language in those community rights ordinances.
I'm a little embarrassed to ask the question because we have a book about the Constitution in our second hour today, but does the term public trust or public trust doctrine appear in the U.S. Constitution?
No, it doesn't. In fact, many of our rights that are recognized today don't have express language in the Constitution. But it's a constitutional doctrine because the U.S. Supreme Court has found that it is applicable against legislatures. So in one of the landmark cases in the public trust called Illinois Central, which was decided in the late 1800s, the Supreme Court found that the state of Illinois legislature was acting outside its authority when it basically gave away the shoreline of Lake Michigan to a private railroad company. The legislature just given away this, you know, very important public resource. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That is outside of your actual authority as a legislature. So that is constitutional, and it's related very much to a doctrine that we call the Reserved Powers Doctrine, which is a constitutional doctrine that says no one legislature can take action to impair the functions, the sovereign functions of a later legislature. And so when we're talking about climate, relating it to that, the doctrine would say no one legislature can consign us to runaway planetary heating because that would prevent further legislatures from providing for the citizens. They literally wouldn't have the resources to sustain a sovereign state. Now, the case just filed in federal court, which is an atmospheric trust case, also combines constitutional rights that are more familiar to us, like the right to life, liberty, and property. And that case is a huge historic case filed right here in the District Court of Oregon against the Obama administration and its agencies, demanding a climate recovery plan, like the other cases, but on the federal level. And that case says that the youth of this nation have rights to life, liberty, and property, and those are jeopardized by climate disruption.
I wonder about the trial courts and how well equipped they are to deal with public trust doctrine, because the way you describe it as a fundament that actually is beneath the statutory law that is so often dealt with in courts. I wonder if lawyers get looked at like they're showing up with a broadsword for a machine gun fight.
That's a great. That is true. The judges are the judges that are in the courts today tend to be younger, and they have grown up with this statutory system, and that's basically all they know. And so they are not used to dealing with citizens' fundamental rights. Now, the older judges I find who were judging before the statutory era. Remember, the statutory era is really recent. It's a huge legal experiment in many ways. It started in the 1970s, but the older judges who were judging before then absolutely tend to understand these public trust rights and also other basic foundational principles. But the newer judges have only seen the statutory law and frankly have learned only that in their law school education.
Hmm. We got time for a quick question from Charlie near Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, and Mary Wood.
Hi.
Hi, Mary. I had a question about open range in regards to grazing, how it's abused in this county. But the county still sits with the ranchers, at least the past few years anyway. Do you see any change in the future in this respect?
All right. Thanks for that, Charlie.
Yeah, I'm pretty much focused on climate and water issues, Charlie. The public trust does reach, I believe, to all ecology and all matters involving natural resources. So to that extent, it's very relevant, and I can tell you the main principle to bring to bear always is the government agencies must manage the trust for the beneficiaries, for the people. Now, how that, and that is just unassailable, but how that plays out in specific context with grazing, I have not given that thought.
All right, a whole lesson we've gotten today on asserting public trust rights, which is actually the title of Mary Wood's discussion at the Climate Summit in Medford on October 13th, Asserting Public Trust Rights to Secure Our Climate Future. Mary is the Faculty Director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program at the University of Oregon School of Law, where she is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Law. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mary Wood.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.